Well, but for my Magic the Gathering SaaS application, C++ really good.
And welcome back to another episode of the Refactored Podcast, where it's our goal here to suck just a little bit less each and every day, closer than ever to the brink of sanity. My name is Chris Tonkinson.
And I'm just chilling in the basement of the Ivory Tower. My name is Frank Cole.
And this is episode number 163, recorded Friday, March 7th, 2025, wherein your illustrious heroes have just learned this just in. Play the Morse code, right?
I'm going to have to get the Morse code sound effect now.
We'll do it in post. It's fine. Play it this just in. Starting with post, this is a little bit of old news, but starting in Postgres 15, non-admin users do not implicitly have create privileges by default anymore. And so that's just a PSA for anybody that's upgrading from 14 finally. That's going to get you at some point when you run a migration.
Yep. So you have to explicitly grant it, even when you do grant all privileges, which I don't know.
Like, yeah.
If you're doing all, isn't it implied in the all? I can understand having a shorthand block to say CRUD only. Insert, update, you know, create, insert, update, delete records, and then a separate command for table. I can certainly see that. But if I'm saying all privileges, I mean all freaking privileges. What the hell, Postgres? Come on.
Well, I guess they have like a manage or I'm sorry, I beg your pardon, a maintain privilege now that has like some, I don't know. Look, man, I just work here. Okay.
The database is Postgres. Supposed to be the one area though. It's supposed to be the one area. Anything. It's just safe. It just works.
I just install
the database and it's just and there. I grant a user to do crap and it's there. And if I want to do an export, it just dumps a file and it just works. It's very nice. It's very sane. Very mindful.
Very mindful in a Linux environment. No, this is very chaotic. This is very nonsense. Postgres is one of the more annoying systems, like from a management standpoint.
It's not that it's
bad or wrong. It's a Friday afternoon. Like maybe we should go there. Maybe we should say things are bad and wrong out of pocket just to get people fired up. Not that it's bad or wrong, but it just does things so differently. Like if I want to install and I installed and managed any number of MySQL instances, like I know you have,
right?
You install the daemon, you configure it with a root password, and then if you want to create users, if you want to create databases, if you want to grant privileges through that root user, you log in to the MySQL command line, or you know you can use a GUI tool, but the process from the Linux command line is to run SQL statements into MySQL with that root account. And that's as complex as it is. If you're on MySQL server, MySQL server, yeah. If you're on Microsoft SQL server, then you have SQL Server Management Studio, right? Mm-hmm. SSMS, which is not a bad tool, to be honest. You know, I'm no Redmond apologist, but SSMS is really not a bad system.
It's not bad.
But then it's there. You can create your databases. You can create you can do all of the things. And they have a special window for privileges, which make things fairly obvious. Postgres, again, if you're just doing like a bare Linux install and management of it, and that's not typically how people are doing it these days, you create the system, but then you have to create a system level user for Postgres. And if you're going to do certain things with Postgres, they're command line tools that are then like only by default available to that specific system user, and then to log in you've got to go into that user to get into Postgres, and then once you're in there the permissions they're okay. You could say it's a more robust system because they're more granular, but when I go in to say hey I want this service account to be able to do all of the things, well I've got to grant all privileges, and to your point that's kind of where you stop with other systems. Grant all privileges, done. Like that, yeah, the word it's funny that you see the word all in there.
It's funny what that word all means.
as if that's not somehow foreshadowing, that you then have to grant privileges to functions, and you then have to grant privileges to sequences, which are like discrete objects within Postgres to manage auto increments. And like, there's all these extras. So at the end of it, now to create a fully provisioned service account that can do all the things, and somebody's going to write in, I can hear it all. Well, that's not the way you're supposed to manage. Send it to Frank at refactor.org.
At dev null. You send it to dev null, as far as I'm concerned.
You know, now there are 5 grant statements that you've got to run. And like, okay, how often are you creating new database users? Like, what is your process for that? It should be automated anyway. This is really a non. Yeah. Like, I'm mountaining out of molehilling to a large degree here.
Yeah.
But like, I don't. It is so. Coming from mostly, exclusively, like MySQL and SQL Server for a large portion of my career, it's like there's always more steps with Postgres.
Yeah.
And I love it because, like, from what I can tell, it scales very well. It performs very well. It's fully featured. The plugins are a lot easier to manage than other systems. Like, it's got a lot to like, and I love it. And if I'm going to, like, file new tomorrow on a project, I'm rolling Postgres, because why would you not? And I just get a little annoyed at it.
Yeah, the user permission scheme. So I think that one of the big reasons that Postgres has, there are a number of things that Postgres does differently and better than its major alternative, open source alternative, MySQL or MariaDB, depending on how you want to count things these days.
In the year of our Lord 2025, and this happened 15 years ago.
It's been a while.
The SQL schism.
Yeah.
Is it Maria, which is the way I've always said it, or is it Maria?
I always thought it was Maria.
Is it Maria?
I thought he actually didn't he name it like after his daughter, wife, girlfriend, mother, something? I feel like that's where the name came from.
Well, that seems like we gotta take a punch out of this guy's nerd card. If he's naming a database, it was his daughter.
Ask the AIs. What's the name origin for MariaDB?
It's his daughter. But my point is, this guy's not a proper nerd, because if he really wanted street cred, he would have named his daughter after the database, right? He's got that the wrong way around.
Actually, this according to ChatGPT, unless it's hallucinating, this is actually pretty funny. It actually follows a naming tradition that MySQL was named after his other daughter, Mai. So is he Asian?
That's a mind blow.
Is that true? MySQL name origin daughter? Like, I want to find something that's not AI generated.
You sound like one of those meme videos where it's like anthropomorphizing Google or ChatGPT when somebody's yelling like incoherent words, salads at it.
So I have found an actual non-generated article. This is absolutely true. His other daughter's name is Mai. So the first one was MySQL for his daughter. The second one was MariaDB for his daughter, his other daughter.
So we have his. So we have his first pick and the one he got right. Is that the subtitle? I saw a video the other day with this lady. It was like, you know, kids are like pancakes. No matter how hard you work, the first one always comes out a little weird.
I had no idea. I always thought it was my, as in the word my, it's my sequel. It's right. not
your sequel.
Yeah. Well, I mean, not yours, not proprietary sequel. I always, oh my gosh, I am. How have I gone top search result in the search that I did here today? I learned MySQL is named after the co-founder's daughter and not the word my. Yeah. Like, how did I go this long and not know this? How?
It's an unhyped DLC of knowledge drop. That's what we got here today.
That's really cool. I think that's super cool, but also, wow, that really flew under the radar for a long time.
I hope for Maria's sake that she was not born when MySQL was invented.
That's a big gap in age, dude. I mean, that's a huge gap in age. If Maria was not born when my Oh, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying.
When he named my sequel, I hope that Maria was not already
born so that he did not have to actually pick which was his favorite daughter and thus broadcast it to the world. Yeah.
Right.
I'm following you.
My wife's telling me that there's some celebrity or whomever that has named their children basically bronze, silver, and gold.
Oh, stop. Seriously? Really?
Gold, sterling, and bronze or something like, but basically bronze, silver, and gold. Like, I don't care how you justify it. Like, as
you
a
can't
parent,
justify that.
I don't care how you justify it. I don't care how you explain it. I don't care what your theme is. It's, oh, they're all precious metals. You cannot have three children and name them best, second, and
third. No.
You know, loser number two. Like, you can't do that.
Did you read Freakonomics? I feel like you did.
A million years ago. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So they had there's a whole write up in the Freakonomics book about names and how they correspond with socioeconomic status. Like what your name, the question does having a hoity toity name.
Does having a rich white waspy name.
Does that mean you're going to be successful? And if you're going to have or like, you know, like urban names or, you know, trailer park names, does that lead to trailer park results? And I remember in that article, in that chapter, he opened with an idiot, a moron who named his two sons Winner and Loser. He named his two sons Winner and Loser.
Winner
became a drug addict and he was in jail and like he was not a winner. And Loser became a cop. And they don't call him, they call him Lou. He goes by Lou.
Right.
But I mean, it's a sample of one. So take it for what it is. But
it's a pretty cool anecdote, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a pretty wild
anecdote. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I don't care how if they both wound up being like philanthropic hedge fund managers. Like, I don't care. Like, that still sucks for them. It still sucks for them that their names are Winner and Loser. That's just out of pocket.
I would rename I would go by my middle name. I would rename myself. I would do something.
I would file for, what is it called? Emancipation. Like, immediately.
Yeah, and then change my name, change my legal name. Holy crap.
In one fell swoop.
Yeah. That's awful. That is just awful. So anyway, my sequel is named after his daughter, Maya. I had no idea that Monty Wideness was, how about that? That's another one. So, cool. I have more huge.
Well, naming stuff is hard.
Naming stuff
you have huge
is
news.
Hard. I told you.
I told you so. Is it, it's a gloat fest? Saying I told you so to the market, or is it you, I told you so-ing me? Because I need to be prepared for my level of excitement here.
No, I'm not rubbing your nose in it this time.
Okay.
I'm not necessarily rubbing the audience's nose in it. I just like to announce that when I'm right, I'm right, because it happens, all the time. But I'm really right this time. So, article came out of the Business Times, headline: servers likely containing NVIDIA chips exported to Malaysia may have been bound elsewhere. I'll give you one guess where that elsewhere might have been.
You're now you're out of my depth. Bound. That's a particular manufacturing word referring to like assembly of these devices, or what does this mean?
So here's that an anonymous tip off about computer servers that might contain NVIDIA chips being exported to Malaysia, where they weren't supposed to go, and then possibly onto an unknown location. And the some of the people that were arrested were Chinese nationals in this scheme. So we have servers.
You said Chinese nationals and scheme in the same sentence, and like nobody's surprised.
I mean, I repeat myself.
Sorry.
But I repeat myself really more than.
Yes. Sorry to be redundant.
Chips exported to Malaysia, possibly to an unknown destination, sparked off a police investigation. Alert did not come from a country or sovereign entity, but the claim was serious enough to get Singapore authorities to launch an independent investigation. Preliminary investigation shows servers from U.S. firms Dell and Supermicro were sent to Singapore-based companies. The servers were then exported to Malaysia. He said these servers likely contained items subjected to export controls by the U.S. So, I mean, this is, it's so obvious. Gee, Chris, I remember, I don't know, 5 seconds ago, remember way back when we were talking about how the whole market was going bananas about how amazing DeepSeek was and how it, like, they were able to do it on the cheap and they without any NVIDIA chips and all of their own original data. Well, I seem to recall that on our last episode, I talked about how OpenAI is openly accusing DeepSeek of stealing their data. So we have the two biggest claims: no major Western chips and all of our own original proprietary stuff, both of which under massive fire. Who could have seen this coming? Could have seen it? Oh my God.
I am amazed right now.
Shocked.
I feel shocked and amazed at this news.
It's ridiculous.
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
And here's your winnings,
you know,
sir.
Do you know how many billions of dollars in value were wiped out when that story hit?
Well, there's an old...
Now, yes, it's all derivative bullcrappery from Wall Street.
And as more of this, and so the silver lining, and as more of this information comes true, the market's just naturally going to recover. Oh, China was full of crap. Yeah. Market values come back up. Like, that's naturally going to happen. You're not wrong, though. You're not wrong. Yes, it did. Like, overnight, the valuations on some of those AI properties drop through the floor, and AI adjacent properties drop through the floor because, oh, DeepSeek's so amazing. I didn't buy this for a second. I always thought that this was a Chinese scam. Always.
Yeah.
There's just no way. There's just no way that for them to come up with something and not stand on the shoulders of those who came before them. I just didn't buy it. It was such a highfalutin claim.
You can go back and you can look at like archival footage and tours and whatever. You look at some of the Soviet era technology that they were, quote, competing with us on. Now, first of all, for any non-student, I won't get like too off the, you know, podcast.
It's
all right.
It's your job
to
throw us off track. It's fine.
It is my job to distract everyone with random shaggy dog tails that don't go anywhere. But for anybody who doesn't know, like, the United States put itself through real paces in most of the 20th century trying to keep up with the threat from the Soviet Union. That was military threat, and it was scientific threat, and it was economic threat, like really existential stuff, or at least that's the way that that was the milieu, right? Mm-hmm. And we, over decades, we, the United States, having gotten all of the money from Europe, just like all of Europe's money went from Europe in 1900 to the United States in 1950. That was the net effect of the world wars for the American economy. Mm-hmm. So you had this confluence of like industrial ramp up, scientific innovation, national pride, and all of the old world's coffers led to the prosperity that we saw in the middle of the 20th century in this nation. And then the Soviets are nipping at our heels, and there's this race, and we're constantly neck and neck, and they beat us to space, but we beat them to the moon, and there's all this brinksmanship going on. And then it turns out, when the Soviet Union collapses some decades later, they weren't as sound as we thought they were.
Shockers.
They didn't have as much as we thought they did. And it turns out, in deeper retrospect, that a lot of their technological, be they societal or militaristic advances, were stolen from us in the first place. Yeah. So they said they had a thing. We rushed to build something better and did it. Like, and I'm not like a jingoist, but like, we did that.
We did it.
We didn't just meet that threat, but we went beyond. And then it turned out they had copied the thing that we had before and sold it up. And then when they found out that we had built the next thing, they started stealing plans, but couldn't actually implement them and couldn't do it at an industrial scale. Right. And so that process continued until their entire society collapsed, really.
Yeah, because it was a house of cards built on sand.
It's a house of cards.
Yeah.
It was a house of cards. Mm-hmm. Like we were honestly competing to what we feared they might have, and what they had the whole time were just paper tigers. And so you look at like their the Soviet space shuttle program and all of this stuff. It's like, oh, that looks awfully familiar. Those designs seem to ring a bell, right? Mm-hmm. Hello.
Yeah.
And you look at the Chinese tech market, and it's like a lot of the same stuff, except the difference is tech, you can kind of cheat and put it into for a while. It's not sustainable. It's not sustainable, but you can kind of fake it.
I was going to say the distinction in this case is everyone actually knows that China is stealing. Like we know there's evidence of straight up, government level espionage into businesses and the federal government to steal information and then use that for their own benefit. I mean, we know for a fact that they do this. The entire TikTok, the entire Trump's threat to ban it, and then we'll leave it open, but somebody's got to buy it. It's got to be U.S. based. That's because we know that it's a Chinese op. Straight up, it is a Chinese op. Like it is stealing tremendous amounts of data off of your phone. If you're paranoid, I know a lot of people say, "Well, I don't care what they say." Okay, well, fair enough. If you feel that way, fine. But if you're in any way concerned about people getting a hold of your data, you should not have TikTok on your phone. TikTok is straight up stealing everything off your phone and sending it to China.
Hang on.
Full stop.
Hang on.
Should I be ringing the bell?
That bell, because that is some thick sliced maple cured smoky bullshit. Okay. Because if you think, why do I care? Right. And this is just my honest, like gut knee jerk reaction here. Hot take. Why do I care that the Chinese government or some Chinese for-profit arm of the Chinese government has the same data that Uncle Jeff and Uncle Mark and Uncle Tim and Uncle Bill have been siphoning off from the American apps for two decades now?
Well, I mean,
you think for a minute that Facebook, that Google, mm-hmm. that Amazon have not been doing the exact, we invented espionage capitalism. Like we invent, or surveillance capitalism, pardon me. We invented that, right? So like, why do I care about TikTok? Convince me that that's different or worse.
Okay, so, I mean, at a fundamental level, China is a foreign national entity with access to a military. Ostensibly, we don't live yet in a corporatocracy. Is that it?
Corporatocracy.
Corporatocracy. We don't yet live in a corporatocracy.
I listen to a podcast that's like news and politics, and they'll often, it's an intentional choice, they will often say corporation instead of country.
I mean, I get it. I know people like
company instead of country.
Yeah. Like I understand that we are heading in that direction. The entire baseline of the Deus Ex game series is about this idea that corporations end up running the world. Anyway, we're not there yet. So Facebook and Google, so they're not a government entity with access to a military and big guns, literally and figuratively. They're also, That's distinction number one. Distinction number two, they're U.S. entities. And I will take people who are at least wearing the same colors over people who are not. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying I'm on board with them collecting a ton of crap and doing God knows what with it. I have problems mm-hmm. with that, but I'm going to sidestep that. I'll take that over China stealing my stuff. This feels like just common sense to me.
Let me ask a question that I have not seen anyone pose.
Okay.
What data are they stealing?
What data are who
stealing? What info? TikTok, the Chinese, the Chiners. What data are they stealing? Let's be specific here.
So my through some past work with folks that came out of the NSA, I have it on unofficial.
You're gonna drop a sources familiar with the matter. That's fine.
I'm gonna drop a sources very familiar, very, very, very familiar with this scenario. All but confirming, because they couldn't, because rules, that TikTok is basically stealing the TikTok app is stealing everything off of your phone, like everything. It is getting a hold of.
Be specific. Enumerate some specific examples, because it's important to the point I'm trying to make.
Names, emails, phone numbers, your credit card information, purchasing history, your app activity, like any information, any and all information that is coming and going off of your phone, they're seeing it. And I'm talking about sidestepping.
How?
And this is where I have
to
go.
I have been looking at the security white papers and the best practices, and I've been looking at the posture and the information security documentation that has been coming out of Cupertino for 15 years now.
Yeah.
If I am not giving the app permission for things, then what is the probably $20 million worth of unpublished zero-day CVEs in the iOS ecosystem that is enabling the app to do this? Because those are material. Those are not just holes. Those aren't even like, let me fire a bazooka at the side of a barn holes. Those are, let me nuke a hole in a county sized holes in iOS security posture. So how is the TikTok app accessing that information around all of the security perimeters that Apple has put into their ecosystem?
So unpublished 0 days. Again, this is where I go sources familiar, and I sort of hit the limits of what I know. And I actually, as I'm thinking about this in answering your question, this is about as close to tinfoil hat as I've ever gotten, but I'm doing it based on.
Oh, slice it thick, dude. Slice it thick. I'm ready for it.
But,
I'm here.
But I'm basing this on valid information that I have heard from sources that I trust and would be in a position to know. Unknown, unpublished 0 days that China is exploiting. There is also, as far as the Apple ecosystem goes, a strong suspicion that Apple is actually looking the other way on some of the on the approval process for the TikTok
to be able to continue to operate in the Asian market.
Yes.
And we say Asian market.
Yes.
It's China, right? Like,
yes. So we're talking about that classic, like, okay, if you want to come into, we'll let you into China. We'll let you, the Chinese government will let you operate in China. You can sell your stuff and make, you know, gajillions of dollars. And then we're going to, it's classic mafioso behavior. And they come back for favors. And one of the favors is you're going to approve this TikTok app and you're not going to ask questions about the code.
So you think there's an unofficial policy within Cupertino not to enforce, like, not using private APIs, not exposing, like, not publishing vulnerabilities, not patching them,
or giving them advance notice.
You think there's culpability within Apple Incorporated
in facilitating this? Based on what sources have said to me, is that going all the way to Tim's office is we're going to do whatever the hell we want with this app. It's going to be built however the hell we want. It's going to do whatever we want. And you're just going to approve it. You're just going to let it all go. Whether the app is built in such a fashion that it would, anyone else doing this would never get it approved ever. Yeah. That is what I have been unofficially told. And the reason for that is just the strong arming of Apple into the Chinese market. That is the understanding. Now, that this is, take it with a huge grain of salt, right? This is secondhand information. I wasn't there, but I also...
You weren't in Uncle Tim's office when this conversation happened?
I was not in it. Right, exactly.
Oh, my God. Your journalistic integrity is shot.
Exactly. So take it with a huge grain of salt, but that is what had been intimated to me. Mm-hmm. And it's entirely possible. I see no reason not to see that as a very real potential outcome here.
It is both technically and financially feasible. Like I can see.
Yep.
Again, tinfoil, that's fine.
It's a little tinfoil-y. I get it.
Unsubstantiated tinfoil. Okay. I kind of don't care still.
You still kind of don't care. You go back to what you said before about the distinction between what's the difference if China has it versus what Google and Apple and everyone else has it.
For context, in terms of social media, I have the TikTok app on my iOS device. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have Twitter or Facebook or Threads or
any of them.
Vines. I have nothing else. Yeah. I have nothing else. And partially, they serve me no value. And partially, I don't like the companies.
Okay.
Like, sure. I just don't like and don't trust the companies because I know for a fact they are stealing as much data as they can. Stealing. Collecting under the terms of the end user license agreement. Right? Like,
sure.
But they're hoovering up all the bits that they can.
Sure. Of course they are. Goes without saying.
Like, when they started, like, you want to hear my tinfoil, and this goes back quite a while. My tinfoil was that when they first started allowing, stay a while and listen, kids. When we first had feature phones that had cameras and the likes of like Facebook just got their first batch of rudimentary apps on mobile devices.
Okay.
You were able to take a picture with the phone and then upload the picture to Facebook, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In the moment, my tinfoil was, oh, great. They're data mining that. So that when they see me take a selfie, they'll notice the Dell laptop and the can of Coke in the background, and that will go into their tagging algorithm for ad targeting. Like, that was immediately, and then, oh, they want to allow people to take videos, and they're encouraging people to take videos. Great. Well, that's just a billion still frames of imagery of you in your home.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you want to talk about segmenting a market.
Yeah.
If you want to talk about getting intel on a person and what things they like and building a profile that you can then bump up against other profiles and make do predictive analytics on, getting a video from inside somebody's house is batshit crazy. Like, that should give every marketer a raging hard on, because that is like, I don't know how much more intrusive, other than literally giving you access to my bank account, hello Mint and the like. Yeah. I don't know how much more intrusive you could be on somebody's personal and spending habits from an ad targeting standpoint. It's always been my baseline thesis.
I never
proved that they're doing it. Nobody's ever said that they're doing it. I've never looked for validation, because this is like, I think everybody should be awarded, just as a human right, Frank. I think everybody should be awarded a core set of conspiracies that they're allowed to just cling to till the dying breath. And this is one of, like, I don't need confirmation bias. I don't need evidence. Like, I know in my heart that this is true, because it's exactly what I would do if I were a shitbag surveillance capitalist.
Yeah.
In charge of a bazillion dollar tech company. Like, that's, it just, well, it's, I mean, logic. It's like, it, I mean, follows.
Power corrupts. Right? I mean, like, you have the ability to do the thing. Why would you not do the thing? I mean, yeah, I get it. Right. But I still draw, I mean, you can get cynical about it. There is still a distinct line here that they are corporations, not a government entity. And they also are subject to U.S. laws and restrictions. Now, does that mean that they're not
doing things that
are borderline abusive? I agree. But
you do know that offices of the central of the intelligence community, you do know that the intelligence community have branch offices in the headquarters of our social media firms.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm aware. Yeah.
So, like, I don't think there is as much a separation between U.S. company and U.S. government as what you're warranting.
Oh, no, yet. I don't think that there is necessarily, but they're still the good guys. Like, I've got it, and there is
that's a little jingoistic. Worth a good guys.
I mean,
we're the good guys. That's a strong state.
If I can't root for my own team, dude, I mean, you know, nobody, I don't think any government is perfect, but like, I got to think we're doing better than the other guys. I mean, I'm not saying it's perfect, but.
Okay. I'm going to call that a little bit of hopium, but that's fine. Like I don't,
all right.
A little bit of copium.
Maybe.
I'm not anti rock flag and eagle, but like I have no, you know, that's just me personally. Like I'm not trying to throw shade. I know my tone sometimes is like, no, I'm not trying to throw shade.
You're good.
That's just me personally. We're not the evil empire, but we're not the scrappy little rebel alliance either, you know?
Well, yeah, that's because we're not living in a sci-fi fictional movie either. Like there's,
Which just sucks, dude. I really still want a lightsaber, right? Life what man doesn't?
Life is, unfortunately, there is no Jedi and Sith. There's just these massive shades of gray. And depending on what's going on, you, the people around you, your family, your government can vary in those things. So,
you're trying to make it all serious and deep and whatnot. I'm trying to talk about lightsabers and blasters.
You're trying to pull us back to lightsabers and blasters away.
Get on my level, like way surface level here. I'm way at the surface level. You're trying to talk super serial. I don't know what we're doing. What are we even talking about here?
All right. So what do we got left here? We had a little bit of time. We were involved in a conversation, you and I, earlier this week. And then it sort of got rehashed a little bit later in the week. Do you think you're picking a stack to start a new project? Okay.
Okay.
Doesn't matter what the stack is. Doesn't matter what the project is. Are all stack choices ultimately and fundamentally a religious choice? And by that, so while you're pondering that, a little bit more background for the audience here.
That's a matzo ball I threw that
right at your face, and it's sticky and gross. And so, for the audience, when you're choosing a stack, obviously, what are you building? What's the best tools for the ecosystem? What are others? What is popular today? What has a large base of users, engineers who are familiar with the stack? Like there's all kinds of real practical fundamental things that go into the decision making. But also when you tally all that up, a lot of it can sort of even out. Like it can come out in the wash, or does it? I don't know. And the decision can ultimately come down to what you like to write or what you're familiar with writing. And so are all of these stack choices really just a grand exercise in ultimately just picking your favorite and, you know, just not invented here syndrome, just masquerading as a legitimate choice?
I say this as much as I can say it without it sounding like a cop out. You ready for this one?
Oh, this ought to be good.
Yes and no.
Oh, jeez.
Right. Like if you want to be an existentialist and unwind every question and unpack every decision down to the ultimate heat death of the universe, then no, none of it really matters, and it's all just holy wars. That's all just preference and you know, religion. On the other side of the spectrum, and you know, I could push my glasses further up my nose and say, well, but for my Magic the Gathering SaaS application, C++ really, you know, the reality is somewhere in between. Now, like I said, like is it always a religious choice? It can, and I think that's kind of like asking. Are political parties always corrupt? No, not by definition.
No,
in practice, most of them tend to be right. Like in reality, reality, usually, like if you're going to coin flip it, it's not a coin. It's better than a coin flip. The political party is corrupt.
Okay.
is a stack choice at a firm a religious issue? I think in a lot of cases it winds up being that. Mm. But not for the reasons that it should be, right? Mm. Like for me, you said it right there, comfort and familiarity. So for me,
certainly counts.
There's this old saying that execution beats each strategy for breakfast, right?
Sure.
Like if you can go out in the market and do a thing, then that is far superior to thinking it through more carefully and having a thoughtful plan. No, you went and did a thing that's going to win in the market.
That is why, by the way, NDAs are not worth the paper that they're printed on.
But Frank, my idea could be worth $20 billion. And I can't talk to you about my startup until you sign this piece of paper because you'll steal it and you'll make all of my money. Yeah. There are like 9 logical fallacies tucked up in one neat little package there.
Such crap. NDAs are not worth anything. I mean, sign it if the person needs to talk to you, but don't waste your time. God, what a load of crap.
Goodness gracious me.
Execution over strategy. I agree. Absolutely.
And likewise, teams over tech. A group of people who share energy towards a common goal, who get along professionally. We don't have to make this we're a family. Anybody tells you this is a family, get the hell out of here.
Is that right? That language to me, red flag. If I hear companies talking about family, that's a huge red flag. I am here. This is a business transaction. You're paying me money for my service. My service involves me working with other people that you're also paying for their service. And so we have to, by definition, get along. But like, we are not a family. And if you try to throw that crap at me, I know that either one, your culture is toxic garbage, or two, you're trying to take me for a ride and get work out of me and not pay me a valid amount for that.
You're driving through like more kind of like exurb, like rural type ish areas, and there'd be like some factory on the side of the highway, and it's like the 1 billion square foot facility for miles, and always they have like the hugest American flag you've seen in your life out front. My wife and I love spotting these. They're fantastic. We're like a family here is a rural factory American flag sized red flag. Mm-hmm. Like it, you could not signal more clearly that something is wrong.
Right.
It could be more or less intentional and malicious, but something is clearly wrong. Yeah. Agreed without like no notes, as the kids say.
Yeah. So yeah, totally. What the hell were we talking about? I derailed you.
You did. Nice job.
Hey,
nice job.
Hey,
That's
right. Points for me. Right. Go me.
This is good. After 163 episodes, we're starting to develop a little back and forth, a little rapport. Yeah, it's good. So for me, like the religious issue, you know, the team matters over the tech. And so having people that get along, having people that share a common goal, having people that are energized by the vision, and having people that are comfortable and familiar with the tooling, that has a real impact on speed, which is to say execution and lower cycle times, right? So for me, if I have like a leadership team within some technical organization and everybody has deep expertise in, I don't know, Kotlin, and we're going to go build something, like you're going to talk about whether Kotlin's the right tool for the job, right?
Yeah, sure. You should.
Okay. Yeah. Any language is Turing complete and you can do the same thing. I get it. And at another level you have, you know, you say, well, because, you know, Python's an interpreted language. It doesn't perform. So I've had this argument with people. .NET is way more performant at runtime. Yeah, and then, you know, it's like, okay, well, let me shove those glasses further up the bridge of my nose and tell you that C is a lot more runtime performant than C#. And then somebody else comes along with an even bigger set of glasses, like the neck is starting to cramp at this point with the size of these glasses, and says, well, you should really write, you know, raw, you know, like RISC architecture assembler, you know, like, It's like, okay, yeah. And then at the end of it, we're just harvesting silicon from the beach to write our own processes.
I was
going to
say,
right?
I beat all of this. So I love these conversations because at the end of it, I always come in from the top rope with the chair by saying, well, I harvest all of my own organic silicon right out of from behind my
right
house
out of the, right, and, exactly.
and build my own boards naturally.
Fabricate your own
I fabricate my own stuff and
integrated circuits.
And I do my calculations with an abacus if at all possible. And so get on my level. Like, where are you?
Right. Well, what are we even talking about here?
What are we
get
even the hell talking out of here. About here?
And so it's like, I think anybody that's got any amount of seasoning as a technology leader knows that your headcount is your most expensive thing and time to market is your biggest risk as a business. And so if I'm going to optimize for anything, it's going to be developer time, developer ergonomics, developer happiness, because, and I don't mean to be all like Steve Ballmer up here, developers, but like that is a real thing that you care about. And so, yeah, if I have a deep bench of expertise with Kotlin and somebody comes along and says, well, technically .NET is better for this particular backend application, that probably doesn't matter because I'm going to get to market faster. I'm going to have a better quality product because I've got a team around it that's excited. And so is that, like, putting this back to you, Frank, like, is that the definition of a religious choice? Because I feel like it's more than that. I feel like, I'm not saying there's no overlap. I'm not saying there's nothing squishy and that it's all deterministic. And then, and so I think it comes down to like the lived experience of your current, or if you're building a team from scratch, now all of a sudden that goes out the window in a big way because you're starting from nothing. Yeah. And so there's a whole other set of criteria that you can, you know, you can go on the popularity charts and the language usage surveys, the annual, you know, Stack Overflow developer surveys, and you can look at GitHub contributions and all this kind of stuff and try to come up with an empirical answer. But
you can try and math.
But it's like, that doesn't hold a lot of water at the end of the day, you know.
I think your description of the team's overall sum total familiarity and comfort level with any given technology set or sets should definitely be a major contributing factor. And I think that a decision can be quantifiably made. But I also think that the quantification has to be so overwhelming in that direction so as to override the personal interest.
That's
actually like a both ways kind of thing. Because I'm thinking about when you get like top-down executive push for like, oh, well, why are you doing that? Well, when I was writing such and such, we never did that. Or, you know, my other team over here from this other thing, we didn't use that, or we did use that and it was terrible, or we didn't use that and it was awesome. Mm-hmm. And you can throw as much math at that person as you want, but if it doesn't, like if it rings hollow for them, well, they're making a personal choice, arguably semi-religious, you know, emotional decision too. So like, it's not just the team picking the code. It's also like the outside forces that say, oh, well, why'd you do that? Like, that doesn't seem right at all. Is your stuff popular enough right now? You know, all kinds of stuff, all kinds of stuff.
And anyway, I think that's an important, there's like a sadly important part of that dynamic, which is if you're defending that choice, if you're in the position to defend that choice, you do kind of have to really avoid the appearance of being a fanboy or an unguarded op. Like, you really have to say, hey, this is why we're making these choices. These are the factors that we considered. These are the things that we find important against our goals. And so for that reason, it led us to this conclusion. You know, rather than leaning on the, well, this is the best. You can't say words like best.
Nope.
And so one thing I try to always lean on in those situations, because it's true, in engineering, there are no solutions. There are only trade-offs. And so if we're going to make a choice, especially one that can get as holy warish as language and framework, then start from first principles. What are the goals? What are we optimizing for? Are we optimizing for quality? Is this code that can never break and can never be wrong? Are we optimizing for speed to market? Is this a thing where weeks matter very, very much so? Are mm-hmm. we optimizing for long-term support? Because we know that this is going to be in a production environment for the next 4 decades, because guess what? There is software that has to live for that long. Like, what are the requirements? And then that drives, and then you overlay team expertise and vibes, because there's a smush factor, like anything else in leadership. There's a mush factor there.
There's definitely a, yeah.
And you can start to narrate, like, then you can start to narrate, like, here's how we arrived at X or Y decision. And then I think it becomes really like a clinical, defensible kind of a, hey, this is where, you know, I love borrowing the medical jargon, but like, in my clinical practice, like, this is my current state of thinking, and this is how I'm doing things, and this is our current state of maturity as a team, and this is what we can handle, and so on and so forth. But I think to make it just for fun, because I feel like this has been a wildly, from my perspective, because we have been living in this for a minute, you and I both, that's like a wildly, like, kind of tempered response. And so I think it's appropriate for me to also say that anything proprietary is stupid and it has to be open source. to inject a little bit of a hot take, like, let's lean into the holiness of it.
Okay.
Because one of the things I've had happen in the past, this is like real experience, and I'm not the only one. I know a lot of our listeners probably have been in this place too. Hey, you ever, Frank, you've done way more consulting, in fact, than I have in my career. Okay. You ever have a client that had something built on Cold Fusion?
Yes. I never had to touch it, thank God, but yes.
Or maybe ActionScript. There are a lot of examples of these proprietary languages and frameworks and systems that once they go out of support, you are screwed.
Right. Yes.
You don't have a professional support network. You don't have a market for talent. If there is any third-party support available, the costs skyrocket. And then when things unexpectedly go wrong, it's a black box. You have no idea what's going on or how the thing is put together. And then along creeps the operating system update. The dreaded, this module is built on .NET 2.0 and Windows updates now need to take us beyond a point where that's end of life. What do you do? Like, do you get into dependency hell? And so this turned into like another thoughtful response. But like, my perspective is the open source systems are like, hey, a step above, or maybe more than a tie. I'm going to say more than a tiebreaker for me. The open source systems more than,
when it comes to
my default pod, like, unless there's a good reason not to use open source, I'm using open source, because when that vendor disappears, when that company blows up or gets acquired or picks a different direction or relicenses, when the operating system goes out of support, when all of the things that are always going to happen to a technology system, because technology is nothing but change, when all of those things happen, at least you have a last resort where you've got the source and you can either understand how it works or maintain it yourself until you can get to a better posture. With a proprietary system, with something that's black box, that's a lever that you don't have. That's like a last resort that you can't pull on. Not to mention the fact that being able to look at the source while you're using it and possibly contributing back and fixing your own problems and not waiting for a company to do it for you. Like, there are other real tangible benefits there. And so for that reason, it's difficult outside of like, maybe I have a stroke and go work in the defense industry, but it's difficult for me to imagine a possible future where I'm ever working in a closed source system.
Yeah. Some clarification on what you're saying here, because I picked it up as you went along, but in case anyone didn't also follow the stitches on that fastball, you're talking about the baseline programming language. Like the core
really fundamentals. It's a trifecta of operating system, programming language, and then framework.
Okay. Yes.
If you want to bundle that, that's what I'm talking about.
The absolute like foundational base of your app that you're building. Not that you necessarily open source the special sauce that you're writing, but the things that you are building it in that you're building and running it in. Yes.
Okay. Have to be open in my mind unless there's some metric unless there's some reason that that's not feasible, have to be open source. Right. Like,
you can wrap them then in all sorts of proprietary crap if you want, because at the end of the day, if those things fall over, your foundation is still,
you fall back.
Yeah. You know,
for 10 or 15 years, I ran my own email and DNS and did all this sort of like home lab infrastructure stuff myself. And I've stopped doing it since then, but only because I kind of got tired. I didn't have as much time as I used to, is really the problem. But I still know how to host that stuff myself if tomorrow I need to, right? Yeah. Because they're open protocols and open systems, and you know, it's just not. I guess it's kind of a lock-in thing, but a lock-in in the face of an industry where there's just no shortage of examples of things you depend on failing.
Yeah,
I got you. Maybe it's a trauma response. I don't know.
I remember I applied for a job way back. I applied for a job with Dave Ramsey at his at his company. It was an engineering position, I remember the alarm bells going off because the interview was just this like rah-rah kind of session for, you know, like, oh, you're going to work for Dave Ramsey, and Dave Ramsey is really looking forward to Dave Ramsey. You know, it was like all this cult of personality, but they built, so that was a huge red flag.
That's unshocking.
Yeah, it's unshocking, but also a red flag. I have applied to several companies over the years where that has been the case, and that was always a red flag for me. Like
turn off. Yeah,
it's a huge turn off. If that's like, you know, oh, because this person is here and they're amazing, that you want to be here too. No, I don't want to do that. That's going to be shitty work. Anyway, their development was all Cold Fusion, and you know, that was the other. So when I put those two together, I went, nah. Pass. Not interested in that. All Cold Fusion. And I thought, man, what idiot.
You're in for some pain. Like I'm going to sign up. Like, I don't know about you, but like when I sign up for a job, like I'm trying to think of this as a long-term commitment, right?
Sure.
Right. I'm not going to join up to be a team Cold Fusion. Cause like I'm seeing 18 months from now, that's going to be my headache to try and thank you.
No way. Yeah. What a pain in the ass. No, I mean, this is going back a ways, but Cold Fusion was still kind of around. Yeah. It actually still is. Cold Fusion, it still exists, but
ugh. Is it? I thought they EOL'd that.
But it still exists. Like it's still out there. Yeah. Like
yes,
like,
the Model T still exists as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So
oh my gosh. God,
movable printed type.
All right, I'll hold off on that. What's up?
Cold Fusion stable release, 23rd December 2024. It's still active.
It's still going.
Yeah. Ew.
Yeah. Is it open source though? Did they open source? Is Cold Fusion open source?
No, it's Adobe. It's Adobe.
Ew. I don't think it is.
I thought they killed it. Oh, I'm so
there's a markup language engine for it, but no, Cold Fusion itself is still completely closed source. Yeah.
No, it's
it's Adobe. Yeah. Adobe bought them. I forget who was it before. They bought them off of somebody else. I forget who. But anyway. Yeah. That wasn't an Adobe original, was it?
I think it was.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was.
I thought they bought Cold Fusion. When did Adobe acquire? Let's game the Jippities. When did Adobe require? You got me saying the Jippities now, by the way. I hope you're happy.
That's not even mine. I don't know where I got that from. Allaire, I guess, originally. Adobe acquired Allaire in 2005.
It was Macromedia. Macromedia.
Allaire was acquired by Macromedia, which was acquired by Adobe.
I don't even remember Allaire, but I do remember Macromedia. I remember Macromedia. Yeah. Being the ones that owned it. And then
they were actually the second recipient.
And they were actually owners. The second.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I learned something. I learned two things today. MySQL and Allaire. Two
things today. All right.
But yeah, Macromedia. That was the one.
Yeah. All right. So I want to end on a going back to some of my favorite stuff on the internet.
Oh my God.
This one.
Movable printed type.
This one should actually be fairly, I think, quick and easy, which is why I'm tacking it on right at the end of the show here. So question from my ever-present favorite Reddit experience devs. How do Amazon devs survive working long hours year after year? Here's the post. Last 6 months for me have been brutal. Meeting an impossible deadline, I work 10 to 12 hours a day, sometimes Saturdays. Most of the team members do that too, more or less. Now that the project was delivered a week back and I'm on a new project, I can tell I'm burned out. I wonder how Amazon devs or fellow devs working at other companies in similar situations do this kind of long hour days day after day, year after year. I burned out after 6 months. How do others keep doing that for years before finally giving in? Answer, they don't.
That's not the neat part. They don't.
This is the neat part. You don't. So this doesn't work.
The question, let me rephrase the question, if I may.
By all means.
How do you sustain the unsustainable?
Yes, pretty much.
That's it.
There is those Amazon devs, and I've actually had the pleasure of working with a couple of guys who ended up going to Amazon or working with them after coming from Amazon. It's a slog. It's a grinder, and they beat the crap out of you. And the reason that they beat the crap out of you is the same reason that they beat the crap out of devs in gaming circles and other populist kind of
prestige.
Spaces. You get to say you worked at Amazon, and they know it. And so they beat the snot out of you. And then when you leave, your takeaway is one, a really good paycheck, because they do pay very, very well. And then two, you get to tell others, I worked at Amazon, and you basically get to, in theory, write your own ticket wherever you want to go. I hate it. I think that is toxic AF. I think it's unhealthy for the industry. I think it's unhealthy for individuals. And I also don't think it's all that effective, because you can do that. You tend to do work in these larger organizations like this, these high tech, lots of specialized people, lots of stuff. You end up being a small cog in you are a tiny fish in a giant ass pond, and you don't get all the experience that you would get otherwise. So I don't like those kinds of roles for a whole host of reasons, not the least of which, I don't fit that mold, and I'm willing to, I acknowledge that, but I also don't think that there's lots of negative, unhealthy outcomes, and this is definitely one of them. So yeah, how do you survive? You don't. You go long enough that you can say that you did it, and then you get the hell out. That's it.
Get your check and leave. And honestly, maybe when you're young and you have energy and patience and optimism, but honestly, don't do it at all. health is the only, if you've got your health, you've got everything. And so, I say this from a place of experience, don't run yourself ragged. Don't burn yourself out like that. Just grinding is not healthy. It's not going to suit you well in the long run.
Yeah. Here's the one counter. Somebody commented, the one argument I hear repeatedly, and I wanted to address this. So there was a comment in here, one in a billion events occur several times a day for them. Even with time and money, that kind of learning experience is hard to get. So
there's some of that.
Okay. So there's two ways to think about this. Okay. There's the one in a billion events that occur several times a day. So there's the uniqueness of the opportunity, but what's your proximity to those one in a billion events? And how much of that are you actually directly addressing? Now, not saying that you can't learn from them, for sure you can, but like how in the room are you for those things? That would be my first question. The other way that I hear this counter argument is, well, they handle billions of events, gajillions of logs, petabytes of data in an hour.
All of the bytes.
Like all the bytes. Like their bar is so much bigger than everyone else's bar. So many more checkboxes, right? Okay. That level of experience, that level of size, where are you going to apply that? Where are you going to take that?
Yeah.
You're going to take that to another company. So you're going to go through the fangs is basically what you're telling me. Like you're going to parlay your knowledge of these giant systems from one giant ass company to another. Well, guess what
you're going to do? Where you're going to get burnout.
Again, exactly. That is not, it's a transferable skill, but it's transferable to such a small pool so as to be irrelevant, I find. And the other thing is, hold on. The other thing I don't like about that is I never bought into the size and scope argument. Like understanding that, yes, when you work with a thing at a certain scale, dealing with the scale becomes its own skill set. I understand and admit that. But that skill set is a superstructure on top of whatever the thing is underneath. So let's take a database, okay? Let's say I'm running a database. It's a Postgres database. And it's now running with jillions of queries on top of it. Okay. Well, great. It's still a Postgres database. And so I'm still just like, what I'm really doing is I'm leaning on my underpinning knowledge and experience of dealing with Postgres. And then I'm just applying another layer on top of that. And you could take, in my opinion, any super confident Postgres administrator, somebody who has built and managed the thing soup to nuts in any size, at any size, and you could throw the giant system at them. And I would say 9 times out of 10, they would figure it out. That's my, I think that that is true. So I don't find that the, well, you've worked it with it at scale. I don't see that as a huge feather in the cap. I don't see that as a distinguishing feature. I know people disagree with me on that, but I don't think that it's a big deal, in my opinion.
9 times out of 10, you're 19 times out of 20, 49 out of 50. How high do you want to go? Your company is going to fail before you hit scale.
Yeah, that's true.
This is my problem with microservices. This is my problem with I mean, all of these choices. Like, and the thing is, with those large companies, like, you know, the people that are in, this is my projection. You know, the people that are really having fun are the physicists and mathematicians, the PhD the candidates who are designing the large system underlying tools. So, like, you don't do anything at Google without a system called MapReduce. And we're out of time, so we don't have time to get it up. But look it up; it's cool. The people that designed and implemented MapReduce, so much of what the company does rests on that, and everybody else is just a user. Yeah, you have to think differently in order to operate at that scale because this is the tooling that you have that's different than the tooling you get from your normal ABC Corp. But the fun work of actually solving that problem and building all of the underlying tooling to operate at the scale is done by not regular developers.
No, it's a whole...
That's my, you know what I mean?
It's a whole theoretical layer on top. When you get to the...
Yeah.
When you get to the fundamentals of dealing with scale as a fundamental science, a lot of it becomes theoretical, like you said, and you end up you're not using the existing tools, you're building from scratch, totally unique things. But again, how's that transferable?
And then the unwashed masses of developers at that corporation are just using that tool.
They're just using that tool. And even if you're super familiar with that tool, well, great. Well, nobody else is using that tool. Where are you going to go with that? Like you're actually pigeonholing. It is literally no different than our Cold Fusion argument. Because that is a proprietary tool. It's actually worse than Cold Fusion because it's a proprietary tool inside of one organization only. It's not even a proprietary tool that's being sold. It's just inside of one org. So anyway, we'd love to hear what you think about any and all of this stuff. Feedback@refactor.work is where you can hit us up. We would love to hear from you. You can find our show notes and our back catalog and all those goodies on feedback. Refactor.work is the website. If you want to check out Chris and his writings, he's over at chris.tonkinson.com and I'm over at hotcoals, KOEHLS.com. And as far as I can tell, this has been episode 163 of the Refactor podcast recorded on, what day is it? March 7th, 2025. Always a pleasure, bud.
Thanks, Frank.